the flowers gone long time ago? Where have all the flowers gone? Young girls pick them, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Where have all the young girls gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young girls gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young girls gone? Gone to young men, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Where have all the young men gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young men gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young men gone? Gone to soldiers, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Where have all the soldiers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the soldiers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the soldiers gone? Gone to graveyards, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Where have all the graveyards gone? Long time passing. Where have all the graveyards gone? Long time ago. Where have all the graveyards gone? Gone to flowers, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn?
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to Dan Arley interviewed by Indra Vizacontas about the honest truth about dishonesty.
Right. And that brings me to another part of your book in which you talk about if you're one step removed from the actual act. So in the way of downloading music, you know, you don't have the artist whose pocket you are picking. Instead, you have this computer and this whole internet and this whole other facade that it removes you from that direct action, that people are more likely to cheat. So can you talk a little bit about how you discovered that particular phenomenon?
Yeah, so let me give you kind of the experiment, and we can talk a little bit about this. So the first condition was the same as the one I described earlier. People finish doing the matrix task, they go to the back, they shred the piece of paper, they come, they declare, they say how much they've made, and we pay them accordingly. In the second condition, when they finish shredding the piece of paper, they come to the experimenter, and they say, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problems, however many they solve, give me X tokens. And we pay them in tokens. They take these tokens. They walk 12 feet to the side and change them for dollars. Now, if you think about it, what's different here is that when you look into somebody's eyes and you lie, you don't lie for money. You lie for something that is one step removed from money. What happens? Our participants double their cheating. Right? Now, think about it. Being one step removed from money for just a few seconds liberated people to that extent from their moral shackle. And think about what does it mean about other things. You know, as a society, we're moving from cash to credit card to electronic wallets. Banks are moving from cash to stock options to derivatives to mortgage-backed securities. And when we deal with other people, we're moving from dealing with people face-to-face to over the phone to over the distance to over the internet. We have outsourcing. Lots of the things we have in society are moving into a direction of bigger and bigger distance. And there's tremendous technological development that I don't want to basically say they're not important or useful. But at the same time, if this distance is creating an easier ability for people to be dishonest and think of themselves as honest, we should worry about it as well. And, you know, people often ask me, oh, is it just a generation of today and people used to be more honest? I think people used to be more honest, but not because people have changed. I think the technology has changed. And I think in the current technology we have, it is just much more tempting to misbehave because there are all these opportunities and all this distance, and we should really think about what are we doing. And I'll give you one last example of this distance. This is probably my favorite example. We asked about 12,000 golf players about how they would cheat in golf. And we asked them many questions, but one of the questions was, imagine your ball fell in the rough, and you kind of wish it moved 4 inches from there, only 4 inches. Would you be willing to pick it up and move it 4 inches? And people said, no, of course not. I can't even imagine doing something. It's just immoral. I wouldn't do it. None of my friends would do it. This is not how you play golf. I can't imagine anything like this could ever happen. And then we asked them, and what about kicking it with your shoe? Oh, yeah, that they could imagine much more easily. And what about hitting it with the club? Even easier. And again, you can see how the same outcome of moving the ball 4 inches would feel very differently depending on the method. And the more distance is between us and our actions, the easier it is to misbehave.
Well, and this is really problematic given that we really are becoming a cashless society. And it's not, I think it's not just for, you know, cheating on ourselves, but also just in terms of the money that we spend. You know, credit card companies thrive on the fact that when you use your credit card, you tend to spend more than if you took out cash from a bank and paid in that way. So I suppose in some ways, this idea of one step removed can apply to a lot of behaviors that aren't necessarily dishonest, but simply not the best decision.
Yeah, and you can think about all kinds of things, you know, the way we treat other people, the way we treat our friends, the way we treat our customers, our shareholders. And the concept of distance, I think, is very general, and it's not just about money. Money is just one aspect of it. But in general, I think we should really worry about it.
So you did find, though, that when someone does cheat and they feel guilty about it, that there might even be some ways in which society has already tried to reset the button and make them feel better about their lives again so that they don't simply go on cheating. So for example, you in your book mention what I thought was a really interesting sort of analogy to the Opus Dei sort of Catholic sect and how the pain that they inflict upon themselves might then kind of relieve them of guilty feelings. And I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about that and how someone who doesn't believe in God might learn from that type of behavior.
Yeah. So first of all, the question of belief in God versus not is quite interesting, and I think there's a whole discussion to say what has religion discovered about you know, reining people's behavior in, and what can we learn in social science from religion. So I'll tell you three things we've learned from religion. Maybe four. The first one is that when we do experiments in which we ask people to recite the Ten Commandments, and then after they try to recite the Ten Commandments, we tempt them to be dishonest, we find that nobody is dishonest. Which suggests that it's not just about fearing God, but the moment you remind people about the moral standards, people behave better. And in fact, even when we take a group of self-declared atheists and we ask them to swear on the Bible, after they finish swearing on the Bible, they don't cheat.
That's amazing.
And this, of course, is something the court system has figured out, right? When you go to court and you swear on the Bible, nobody's asking you, are you religious? They just assume that everybody who's swearing in the Bible, this is going to have an effect on them. And we don't really think about it, but that, of course, it does work. By the way, it's also interesting to figure out how in court we swear first on the Bible and then we give our testimony, whereas in most forms, we fill the forms out and only we sign at the end. Right, and nobody, of course, in a court testimony would get people to swear at the end. You know, give your court, and then you swear that everything you've said is the truth. We don't do that. We think about priming people. We think about reminding people about their moral obligations first, and only then getting the data from them. So religious priming is incredibly important. Reminding people about their obligations, and lots of religions have lots of reminders. Right, we have the cross, we have the Star of David. Depending on the religion you have lots of different reminders. The second thing we've learned from religion, which was kind of interesting for me, in the Bible there's a story, and the story is that God comes to Sarah and he said, Sarah, you're going to have a son. And Sarah said, how can I have a son when my husband is so old? And God said, don't worry, you're going to have a son. By the way, this is my version of the Bible. It's not how it's written.
yeah, and then, it doesn't sound like King James, but go on.
And then God goes to Abraham and said, Abraham, you're going to have a son. And Abraham said, did you tell Sarah? God said, yes. And Abraham said, and what did Sarah said? And God said, Sarah said, how could you have a son when she is so old? And the religious scholars have been there wondering, how can God lie? Sarah said, how could she have a son when Abraham is so old? And God is misrepresenting Sarah as accusing herself. And the religious scholars came up to the conclusion that it's okay to lie for peace at home. Which, you know, in some sense, it's something we all know, right? Nobody would raise their kids to say, you know, whenever somebody asks you, honey, how do I look in that dress? You should always say the truth. Right? So we know that lesson. We know the truth is not the important thing. But in that particular essay, and I've talked to Sir Jonathan Sacks, who is the chief rabbi in England, about this. And what he said, which I found very interesting, he said that in Judaism, it has been recognized that there are many human values. And honesty is one of those human values. And sadly, not all human values are compatible all the time. And then you have to decide, what do you do when human values are incompatible? For example, you don't want to upset your best friend or your wife, and at the same time, there's honesty, and they don't fit together. And what do you do? And then the decision has been that honesty is not the most important thing. Now, the thing about this honesty is that we all understand this lesson. We all understand white lies, which are basically our way to be dishonest but not think of ourselves as being dishonest. The real problem, of course, is what happened when these white lies are not in the personal domain, they enter into the professional domain. What happens if your accountant all of a sudden doesn't want to upset you, right, or doesn't want you to be, that now it's not okay. The same trade-offs that are okay in the social domain are not okay. Another kind of interesting lesson from religion has been about the Catholic confession. When we do experiments and we give people a chance to cheat many times, hundreds of times, let's say 300 times, what we find is an interesting pattern. We find that for a while people cheat just a little bit, just once in a while, as if they're trying to balance, feeling good about myself, cheating a little bit, feeling good about myself, cheating a little bit. But that at some point, many people switch and start cheating all the time. And we call this the what the hell effect. And the idea of the what the hell effect is that we as people think of ourselves in binary terms. We're either good or not good. Now, we don't have to be 100% good to be good. We can be maybe 93%, or if we can rationalize, maybe 91%, and so on. But we think of ourselves as in binary terms. Now, what happens when you can't think of yourself as a good person? You say to yourself, I might as well enjoy it. And then you go all the way being dishonest. And then if you think that you're going to hell in the extreme case, why would you ever stop being dishonest? And the Catholic confession is kind of an interesting thing. And we tested the Catholic confession, and we found out that what it does is to allow people to open a new page. That people cheat a little bit, they start cheating a lot, and then if they give them a chance to confess, to say what they have done badly, and to say that they are sorry about it, all of a sudden they reset their starting point and they start from a lower point. And this is kind of interesting. It's something religion has figured out, and maybe we should try to do it in civic society as well, right? What would happen if we thought about the confession-like mechanism for our bankers and our politicians, right? What would happen if we once in a while created a way for people to restart? And you know what it also means? Why do people restart? It tells you that they want to be more honest than they are. It tells you that people who start cheating a lot would prefer to start from a blank slate, but we don't usually give them a chance. But when they get a chance, people do become better, which I think is quite optimistic.
And, you know, in some ways, we use New Year's resolutions for exactly that, as a chance to reset, or, as you mentioned, a birthday. But I'm wondering, have you looked at whether it matters if the person who's giving the confession actually really believes in heaven and hell and that their sins are forgiven? Or is it simply the act of confessing what you've done wrong that allows you to reset?
So our sample for these studies have mostly been undergrad students, and I think they're mostly a group of atheists. So and we find these results, right? So the question is, how is confession working? By the way, I also think that confession is what South Africa has done with the Reconciliation Act. You ask yourself, how does a country move from an apartheid era to a post-apartheid era? Can we just say, okay, we've changed, let's move on? I think that would be very hard. So the Reconciliation Committee basically announced this procedure in which people stood up and said all the awful things they've done and said that they will not do them again. And I think it's incredibly important. And many more countries in Africa are now starting to adopt that procedure as well. So I think there is something. It's not about any particular belief. There is something about new pages. The question is, how frequently do we need them? Is it like in Judaism, once a year? It's like the Catholic confession. You can do it whenever you feel like it. Is it once a quarter, once an election? I mean, what's the right mechanism? But I think if we implement something like this, we would see the benefit.
Well, I know that you have a very busy schedule ahead of you, and I don't want to take up much more of your time, but I do have one more question that I would love to ask you. And that is, you talk a lot in your book about the relationship between people who describe themselves as creative and dishonesty, that people who score high on these kinds of self-proclaimed tests of creativity, or even who use words such as innovative to describe themselves, tend to cheat more. Can you talk a little bit about that work?
Yeah, so if you think about it, our story is basically about how can you both be dishonest and think of yourself as an honest person. And it's all about weaving a story, telling a tale, saying about why this is actually okay, why is moving the ball actually okay. And some of it is influenced by other components, like the environment and the distance from money and what other people are doing. But some of it also has to do with your ability to tell tales. And who is good in telling tales? Well, more creative people. So it turns out that the more creative you get, the better stories you can tell. Tell yourself, don't tell other people. And you can convince yourself more easily that what you're doing is actually okay. So we find this when we measure creativity, we try it when we teach people or kind of prime them to be more creative. We find it in an advertising agency when we look at the different levels of creativity of people. It's all supporting this notion that what we really need to think about is the human ability to tell a story. Now, if you think about the overall picture from the book, it's basically saying the following. It's saying that when we have a motivating force that is pushing us to see reality in a certain way, we are likely to be able to do it. In the same way that if you like a particular sports team, you're going to see life through the perspective of that sports team, and every time a referee calls a call against your team, you would think the referee is evil, vicious, stupid, blind, something. So that's the first component. You need some kind of force that motivates you to see reality in a biased way. The second thing is that when you have fuzzy rules, when the rules are very clear and strict and you know on which side you are, no problem. But when the rules are fuzzy, all of a sudden you can think that you're doing the right thing when in fact you're not. And finally, it's about rationalization. It's about what kind of story you can tell yourself that this is okay. And I think that if we understood the importance of these three components, we could try to eradicate or eliminate conflicts of interest. We try to make fuzzy rules less fuzzy and more clear. And we should try to do things to reduce our ability to rationalize all kinds of behaviors.
And then, of course, if you're ever in Hollywood where storytelling is king, be extremely wary. Well, thank you very much. It's been wonderful to talk to you. And I do want to remind our listeners that they can get a copy of your book through our website. The book is called The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves, by Dan Ariely. Thank you very much for being on Point of Inquiry.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
After months of investigation and congressional hearings about the Watergate break-in, Americans stopped what they were doing on August 8, 1974, to stare at their TV sets and watch the first president of the United States resign his office.
Good evening. This is the 37th time I have spoken to you from this office, where so many decisions have been made that shaped the history of this nation. Each time I have done so to discuss with you some matter that I believe affected the national interest. In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation. Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. As long as there was such a base, I felt strongly that it was necessary to see the constitutional process through to its conclusion, that to do otherwise would be unfaithful to the spirit of that deliberately difficult process and a dangerously destabilizing precedent for the future. But with the disappearance of that base, I now believe that the constitutional purpose has been served, and there is no longer a need for the process to be prolonged. I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. And my family unanimously urged me to do so. But the interests of the nation must always come before any personal considerations. From the discussions I have had with congressional and other leaders, I have concluded that because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require. I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. For more than a quarter of a century in public life, I have shared in the turbulent history of this era. I have fought for what I believed in. I have tried, to the best of my ability, to discharge those duties and meet those responsibilities that were entrusted to me. Sometimes I have succeeded, and sometimes I have failed. But always, I have taken heart from what Theodore Roosevelt once said about the man in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again because there is not effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deed, who knows the great enthusiasm, the great devotion, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumphs of high achievements, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring. I pledge to you tonight that as long as I have a breath of life in my body, I shall continue in that spirit. I shall continue to work for the great causes to which I have been dedicated throughout my years as a congressman, a senator, vice president, and president. The cause of peace, not just for America, but among all nations. Prosperity, justice, and opportunity for all of our people. There is one cause, above all, to which I have been devoted and to which I shall always be devoted for as long as I live. When I first took the oath of office as president 5.5 years ago, I made this sacred commitment to consecrate my office, my energies, and all the wisdom I can summon to the cause of peace among nations. I've done my very best in all the days since to be true to that pledge. As a result of these efforts, I am confident that the world is a safer place today, not only for the people of America, but for the people of all nations, and that all of our children have a better chance than before of living in peace rather than dying in war. This, more than anything, is what I hoped to achieve when I sought the presidency. This, more than anything, is what I hope will be my legacy to you, to our country, as I leave the presidency. To have served in this office is to have felt a very personal sense of kinship with each and every American. In leaving it, I do so with this prayer. May God's grace be with you in all the days ahead.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
That's all, folks.